Hello. Hello, everybody. My name is David Tessar. I am a technical evangelist based in Redmond, Washington. I was assigned the task of trying to cram all of the 3,500 enhancements to Windows Server 2012 and over 300 features into 75 minutes. Now, obviously, there's no way I'm going to be able to cover that much in this amount of time. However, I am going to try and give you about 70 features and about 15 demos in the course of the next 75 minutes. With that in mind, I'd ideally love you to keep your questions towards the end because we have a lot to show you here. But it's going to be a fun session. You're going to have a lot of interaction here. And here we go. Why Windows Server 2012? I have one marketing slide in here. And I wanted to give you this marketing slide because I want you to think about, as we go through these 70 features, how these features relate to these three pillars. One, comprehensive cloud platform. Well, frankly, you know, Microsoft has its own interests in mind. So you saw Jeff Woolsey, and you saw how he saw how VMs need to migrate between different clouds, you know, between Azure, on-premise. So, you know, with Windows Server 2012, we needed to have that in mind. How many of you have seen our data center videos, like our Gen 4 data center videos? Raise your hands. There's like a couple of you. Okay. So there's some really cool videos online that show you what we do in our multiple billion-dollar data centers. We no longer have racks of servers. We have a trailer on flat car. So it's a big, huge container of multiple racks and thousands of servers. Nobody ever goes into those containers. Right? The big semi-truck pulls up, drops that off, and then you plug in your power, your network, and there you go. You're off and running. Right? So we have to power Bing, Azure, and all these things running Windows Server. So naturally, we needed to put those features into the product itself. All right. Cost savings. How many of you like to go back to your boss and say, I save you money? Are we awake? I mean, hopefully here, all of you like to do that, right? So, no, you like to spend lots of money? I don't know. But at any rate, you know, there's a lot of features inside of Windows Server 2012 that enable you to come go back to your boss and say, hey, look at here, I'm you know, saving the company money. And at the end, the last but not least, supporting a modern work style. We realize that people want to work anywhere on any number of devices. And there's, of course, a client side of that, but there's also a back-end server side of that. And we've made a lot of enhancements in things like VDI and Branchcast to really improve this scenario. Okay. So now that we're done with that slide, this is going to be the framework that we're going to follow for the remainder of the 75 minutes. We've got 7 different major buckets of categories of features. Each of those are going to have 10 different features listed. And again, we're going to cover around 15 features or so. Okay, first off, server virtualization. It is a topic that is near and dear and to most of our hearts, Hyper-V, right? Point one, Hyper-V network virtualization. Well, if you're going to be moving your virtual machines between on-premise and in the cloud, naturally you're going to need to have some kind of abstraction of your IP address layers there, right? So now with Windows Server 2012, you can have 2 different IP addresses, a physical provider, a physical address to the local network and a provider address. That way when you move your VMs across different data centers, wherever you want, it's going to be able to be seamlessly connected and moved between all these different places. The features that you're going to see in these slides with demo, I'm going to cover in the demo, so we're not going to talk to those. So shared nothing, live migration, and Hyper-V replica, we're going to show you here in a minute. Next, massive scale. You heard in the plenary from Jeff Woolsey, he threw out some stats for you on the amount of scale that we've done in Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. Well, here's a slide for you that gives you a little bit more detail of those numbers. You can see here the amount of improvement factor that we've done from Server 2008 R2 is huge, right? Up to 4 terabytes of physical memory, 320 logical processors, and you know, I'll let you read the rest here. But here's where it gets really interesting. Here, how do we compare versus VMware, vSphere? This is the 5.1 Enterprise Plus version of the product. So you can't purchase even any more capabilities for this for VMware here, right? So even at that, even at their highest paid product, we still have at least parity to the scale, or in most cases, as you'll see on the right, two times the scale that we have with VMware. And that's all included right out of the box with Windows Server 2012, either standard or Data Center Edition. There's no difference in that scale. The link at the bottom of that page gives you a 25-page white paper that will give you even more details on our comparison, how we do against VMware. Just here's a fun little question for the audience. I'm curious, which of you has the largest amount of RAM assigned to a single virtual machine? So we're going to do this by show of hands. How many people have assigned, let's say, 5 gigabytes of RAM to a single VM? Okay, I'd imagine that's most everybody. Okay, how about 10 gigs of RAM? How about 50 gigs of RAM? Okay, we got some dropping of hands. Anybody got 50? Okay, there's a few up there. How about 100 gigs of RAM? Drop. I think, is there anybody that still has 100? Has 100 gigs of RAM? There's one over there. Anybody can beat 100? No? All right, we got a winner. We got a winner over here of a shirt. So come on up and grab a shirt. And I'd love to know what the workload is that you have that had, if you let me know how many gigs of RAM you had. Dynamics AX, and how many gigs of RAM did you have to that VM? 110 gigs of RAM. That's awesome. So if you want to have somebody that knows Dynamic AX at a large scale, talk to that guy. All right, let's go back to the Hyper-V slide. Here we have cluster enhancements. Now, it used to be that clustering, you really had a limited capabilities in Server 2008 R2. Right? You can cluster things like file servers. Well, in Server 2012, we've dramatically increased the number of workloads that you can cluster. So you can cluster things like Hyper-V or virtual machines. All different types of workloads are now able to be clustered on Windows Server 2012. Hardware offloading. Naturally, you're going to want to have the most performance from utilizing the hardware that's on the underlying system. So things like network cards that are able to take advantage of that performance, now Windows Server 2012 can do that. Virtual fiber channels. Yeah. We now have the ability to have virtual HBAs, which gives you that additional performance on your network. And number 8. Guest NUMA support. So when you have VMs that have such large scale and numbers like this, you're naturally going to want to have that NUMA support there to be able to take advantage of that additional architecture and those memory capabilities. Number 9, runtime memory configuration. And you saw this with Michael Leeworthy in the plenary session yesterday, where he, you know, when you up the RAM to a virtual machine while it's enabled up to, you know, 16 gigs or however much you want to add the RAM, that's now built into the product. Hyper-V network switch. This was demoed at Tech Ed North America by Jeff Woolsey, where we put in a Cisco Nexus 1000 switch right into the hypervisor. So if you have things like Cisco management software for managing all your IP addresses, you're now able to utilize that management software to manage the network of Hyper-V, right? And this enables a lot of interesting scenarios for extensibility on the network side of things. All right, now enough of slides. You want to see some live demos here. So I'm going to jump into my host here, and we're going to show you, first off, live migration. All right, live migration is extremely easy to enable. When you have Hyper-V running, you're just going to click on the Hyper-V settings, and under the Live Migrations tab here, you'll see that by default, there's two simultaneous migrations. And all you need to do here is check the box to say enable incoming and outgoing live migrations. Naturally, you can enable this via PowerShell. For authentication, you've got two choices there. And as far as the number of simultaneous live migrations, there is no limit. The only limit that you really have is based on the hardware that you have in your environment. Typically, your network is probably going to be your biggest limiting factor there. And I've seen demos where Jeff Woolsey has done simultaneous live migrations of 120 VMs. Right, that's very possible. And of course, from a security perspective, you can make sure that you can protect it so that nobody's going to start trying to live migrate VMs to your host for people that you don't want to have that happen. All right. That's really all that it is that needs to have configured on both sides. But now let's do a live migration of a VM. Now, because we don't have a lot of time for you to wait to have a 10 or more gig VM replicate between these two laptop devices, what I'm going to do is just click on here and choose move. This VM is just a VM that has nothing on it. It's just a blank VHD with no operating system. But we're going to leave it running. Click on move. Move the virtual machine. You'll notice that you have the option to move just the storage or moving the virtual machine. I'm going to move the virtual machine. The destination machine I'm going to have as host 1. We're going to choose next. And once we have this here, you'll notice that there's three different options. Up the top here, you have moving the virtual machine's data to a single location. And if you wanted to have specify, for instance, a particular file folder on the machine that you wanted to store the data, you could. In this case, I'm going to move the virtual machine's data by selecting individual items. It gives you the most control. At the bottom, you'll notice there's an option to say moving only the virtual machine. And this is one of the other things that's new, is that with Hyper-V, you have the ability to store VHDs on file shares. So if you could have a network file share, and that enables you to do things like this, moving just the virtual machine. So you have no downtime, have, let's say, the VHD on a network share, and the VM and the processing and memory resources seamlessly switch between different machines. Well, in this case, I'm just going to do a live migration VM with shared nothing. All I have between these two machines is a network cable. In this case, I'm going to say move the virtual machine data automatically. And we're going to click next. And what this will do is, on the default location on the other server, it's going to enable it to go into the default store for wherever those machines are at. So in this case, it's starting to move. And you'll see here that it's connected up to VM host 2 is where I'm at right now. And when you look at this here, it's moving the virtual machine in storage. So what it's doing behind the scenes here is it's queuing up all of the resources for that machine. And you'll notice there was a quick blip, and now we're on host 1. What it does is there's a live migration where it takes just a second, and it pulls that over very quickly to the other host. So there we go. We just live migrated with nothing other than a network cable between these two machines. Anybody? Anybody like that? Yeah? All right. All right. Now we're going to talk Hyper-V replica. Hyper-V replica is really useful for when you want to have a backup of a particular VM. Let's say it could be the same data center, it could be a different data center, it could be a totally off-site location. And all we need to do here is click on first to enable that in Hyper-V. And again, this can be enabled via PowerShell as well. But it's just a checkbox. Right here it says, enable this computer as a replica server. You can utilize Kerberos, or utilize SSL. Those are pretty standard ports, so that really helps you to have extensibility for where you're going to transfer things, so leaving ports open, making it easy there. And we're going to say allowing a replication from any authenticated server, and here's where we're going to store the replica for that VM. Okay. Now, once we have a VM, all we need to do is just say enable replication. I've right-clicked on this replica VM. I'm going to say enable replication. And for the replica server, I'm going to specify my host 1 again. And here I have the ability to, again, we're going to just use Kerberos authentication. That's fine. It's going to say, which virtual hard disk do you want to replicate? I'm going to use the one that's there. And then you have the ability to specify additional recovery points. You can have up to 15 recovery points, and by default, every hour, it's going to take a backup of whatever that VM is at, wherever the state of that VM is at. It's going to then replicate that over the wire to this other machine. Now, if you have workloads that happen to have documentation for this kind of backup, then you want to follow that. But if not, then you should be okay to be able to utilize this for the backup. I'm going to say to send the initial copy over the network here. But you also have the ability, let's say you had many gigs or even terabytes of VMs. Naturally, that's going to just be impractical for you to try and copy all of that data over perhaps to an offsite. But what you could do is send that copy via media. Right, you ship the tapes or the, you know, in this days, whatever that happens to be, hard drive, right, over to the company to get that started. Here we're just going to start it immediately, and then we're going to click finish. And, you know, not a whole lot it looked like happened here, but what you'll see is that now on VM host 1, we've got this replica VM. It now is going to, every hour, replicate over to this VM, whatever the latest state of that VM is. If you needed to do a failover, it's really simple. All you have to do here is click replication, failover, and choose whatever replication point you want to go from, and click failover. And it's that simple. All right. Management and automation. As you can see here, I'm going to show you a lot of these features in the demo here. But naturally, you know, with having more and more servers, you're probably not getting any less of them or things that you have to manage. We wanted to really extend and make it much easier for you to manage a larger number of servers inside your environment. One of the things that we did, point four there, is we have 2,400 PowerShell commandlets. Making it extremely easy for you to do anything that you could do on the GUI of the console via PowerShell. 5, disconnected sessions. Well, if you are running PowerShell and let's say, for instance, the network goes down, things get disconnected, what is the state? What's going to happen now at that point when you come back? Well, in Server 2012, we have the ability to resume that session and pick up from wherever you left off. Workflows, PowerShell workflows. For those of you who want to get really advanced with PowerShell and you want to make really advanced sets of scripts and saying, execute this chunk of PowerShell code, make sure it executes, and then use all kinds of variables there, that's where we have workflows to support that kind of behavior. Next up, Windows PowerShell web access. For those of you who want to run PowerShell just via your web browser to any of your servers in your domain, we now have the ability to do that. Oh. Okay. And then shared scripting. Of course, we can share these scripts across a number of different machines and making that easier. But let's go now and jump into the demos. Okay, first off, I want to point out that I am on a Windows 8 client machine. You're going to be able to do all of the same functionality that you can on Windows Server from Windows Client using the server management tool. And this is kind of like Michael Lieberly said, you could have a slate. You could have whatever Windows client you want to manage your entire infrastructure. This is your server manager, and this is what you're going to get by default when you first log into a server. And when you go there, you're going to first start out to see this dashboard. Now, the dashboard, you'll notice, pulls up all kinds of different roles here. And you'll see that we have eight different servers total that are in this list. And from there, it detects all the different roles that you have and detects the events, all kinds of useful information that are right there in a central location. You can also do things like click on the alerts itself. And here, you can see that there's a DC that has a CPU alert counter, you're able to do actionable things right from within the console itself to resolve issues. So here we want to stop the performance counter collection, and we click OK. And now that's resolved. You see right there, it resolved an issue right from within the console, and that was on a DC. That was on a remote server. The other thing that you have the ability to do is create different kinds of custom groups. Now, there's a full-blown session, a full 75-minute session that my colleague Rick has on server management to get you a lot more details of this. Again, there are a lot of different features that we're showing you here that have full 75-minute sessions. But what we're going to do now is show you a little bit about how you have the ability to interact from these places. So here you can see with DHCP, we could just right-click on the server, click on DHCP Manager, and you get smart context for wherever you're at. Well, here's where things also get interesting. Let's say you want to install a role on a different server. In Windows Server 2008 R2, that could be a little bit challenging. In Server 2012, you've got a number of different options to do this. Right here, we've chosen Manage, and then Add Roles and Features. And what we can do is add a role-based feature. And then you'll notice here from the server pool of the servers I've added, I can choose the particular server I want to add. I'm going to choose server 1. And then in this list here, I can choose any of the roles I want to add. Click DHCP, let's say, for instance. Click Next. Next. We can enable these tools. The other thing that's kind of handy here, is that at the bottom here, you have the ability to export the configuration settings. So when we click on this, we can see that we can export these settings to a template. If you wanted to do the same kind of configuration, you could export that to an XML and extend that to other machines. Now, that took a lot of clicking. And that is significantly faster than you saw in Windows Server 2008 R2. But we can do everything now via PowerShell, right? Let's go to PowerShell and show you how we could enable a role, enable, let's say, DHCP to be installed on Server 1 simply using PowerShell. So first off, I did open up this new PowerShell ISE interface. And this is extremely useful for you to be able to manage PowerShell. Even if you don't have any knowledge of PowerShell, we have a number of things that really help you out. Now, up here, I have the commands to do the install for PowerShell. But let's say that you don't know what that is. What I'm going to type is install dash. And you'll notice as soon as I typed install dash that there is this AutoSense here, IntelliSense, for picking up which command you want next. In this case, I'm going to say I want to install the Windows feature. You notice the smart context there of what are all the things that are after that. I'm going to click Install Windows Feature, dash, and then I also have roles or other things that are listed there. So I can continue to type out how to install those roles right there from PowerShell. Now let's say another option that you have, that was IntelliSense. But let's say you don't want to use IntelliSense for whatever reason. And here is the commands for all of the PowerShell commandlets that are available to you. So here I can type install, and you'll notice on the right-hand side, it intelligently will tell you the commands that are available. In this case, I'll say install Windows feature. When I click on this, I have the ability to say what's the name and the server I want to install the role on, and then I can insert that into PowerShell. And so when I clicked insert down here on the bottom, it might be hard for you to see, Then, on the left-hand side, you can see how it installed the Windows feature that command into PowerShell. Okay, so I am going to execute this script that's up here, and this is another handy thing for you to know. When you highlight a section of code there, when you click on this button here, this little Run Selected or F8. There, it's going to run whatever that selected code is inside your environment. So with a single click here, I've now installed DHCP on Server 1 from my Windows 8 client. Okay. We've shown you a number of things there as far as the multi-server management. Let's get back into the storage and enhancements to storage. Okay, file system improvements. Again, there's a full 75-minute session on file system improvements. One of the big things here is we have REFS, or real file system. We wanted to rethink, what is it like to, with all of this increased data sizes and virtual hard disk sizes, and what can we do to make the most next generation of file system pass in TFS? Well, REFS is that. Cluster shared volumes. We have the ability to share active clusters within your storage nodes. We have SMB 3.0 for workloads. SMB 3 has a huge amount of performance improvements. And again, there's full full sessions and a number of features that are packed underneath this hood. As my colleagues Rick and Jeff, you may have heard them say, "Fire-breathing dragon is the is the file server, and it's able to with all of these features and improvements that are combined together, you have this amazing badass file server that's able to be extremely high performant inside your environment. Offloaded data transfer. This makes it a lot easier for you to copy files and resources. For instance, when you copy a file between hardware devices that support it, it bypasses the CPU and processing of wherever you initiated that copy from, making copies much faster between those storage devices. Transparent failover. Well, in Server 2008 R2, if you wanted to fail over of, let's say, a file server, either via unplanned or planned, you'd have to kind of wait a little bit for the heartbeat to initialize and some other things to kick over. Well, in Windows Server 2012, it's completely seamless. You want to fail over, there's zero downtime with keeping your file servers highly available. Okay, NFS support. We have enhanced NFS support, and one of the things that I've heard, is that NFS is kind of world class. And I've even heard that many customers, including VMware customers, utilize our NFS and say that our NFS support is the best performance for those workloads. All right, let's dive now into some more demos. Okay, we're going to talk about storage pools. Now, you saw a very quick demo in the plenary about how we added disks into the pool. And in this case, I'm going to dive a bit deeper and show you a little more of how that works. When we go to our file and storage services, you'll notice that I've got a number of different disks here. And these disks are not initialized. So one of the things that you see here is this primordial. When I see primordial, it kind of makes me feel like I'm a little medieval or something. I don't know. But all that really means is that these disks are not initialized. They're just blank disks attached to this VM. And all we need to do here is right-click, choose New Storage Pool, and we're going to type a name. We'll call it an Australian pool. It's a good kind of pool out here. And then we'll choose three of the disks. And up here we have the ability to choose hot spare or just automatically assign that, which is useful if you want to have a disk that you can pull out and remove exchange inside the pool. We click Create. And right there, what we have or what we see is a new pool. Now, that in and of itself didn't really do a whole lot as far as being able to use anything, right? Once you create a pool, you'll see in this list here, there's now not four disks. Those kind of vanished virtually. And so this is one of the reasons why, disk management is the old school way of doing things. Here you'll want to start utilizing the file and storage services within the server manager. But Next up, right, we need to create a virtual disk. So we go ahead and create a virtual disk to assign to this pool. We're going to choose next. And we'll call this Australian VDisk. Choose next. And then you've got three different options for what you want to choose for your pool. Now, mirror and parity, these things sound very similar to with what you're talking about with RAID. Now, it's not exactly a RAID level, although the RAID type technology is inside of here. Once you have two or more disks, you can start to mirror. In this case, I'm going to go ahead and choose parity, which offers the most resiliency and redundancy for backup. Then you've got two options here. It says thin or fixed. Fixed would be the old school way of doing things, where you create a disk and it takes up exactly that much space. Right? It's going to take up that much space on the drive. If you choose thin or thin provisioning, it's going to only use up the space that's utilized on that drive. So I'm going to choose thin. And in the virtual disk size, I'm going to say 1 terabyte. Now keep in mind that we only have 326 gigabyte disks on this deal. And you'll notice there that's 0.37 terabytes that's available. But when we click next, it allows me to create a 1 terabyte drive, even though technically I don't even have that space available to me. So you'll see here, I've got the 1 terabyte disk. And from here, you'll notice in the disk manager, just to kind of give you some back in context, you'll see that now we see this disk of 1 gigabyte inside of disk manager. Well, next, right, like we would need to assign a volume, just like any other disk. And we'll click next. Size, we'll use the full terabyte. And we'll assign drive letter E. We'll call this Australian storage. And I'm going to not enable data duplication. We're going to come back to that in a minute. I'm going to click create. And pretty quickly here, we're going to have a 1 terabyte drive assigned to this virtual machine. So when we open up this list here, you can see, hey, we've got Australian storage, a 1 terabyte drive listed here that's not being used at all. Okay, well, to make things a little bit interesting, I'm going to add now a new virtual disk that's fixed in size to take up some of that space. So this is going to be, let's just say, a fixed disk. Click next. I'll just choose simple. It doesn't really matter for now. Choose fixed again. And I'm going to specify, it says the storage pool free space is 375 gigs. I'm going to choose 370, let's say 2 gigabytes for this disk size. Click OK. And now it's going to take up that 372 gigabytes of space. You'll notice there on this right side, right, that it now give me a notification that this pool is been heavily allocated. You're running out of space on this drive. Well, with a storage pool, it's really easy. How many people here have ever had to ever ran out of storage space? Show of hands. Like everybody, right? Okay. Does somebody have a good quick story on what you had to do once you ran out of storage space? Anybody want to volunteer? Quick one? Anybody? No. You got a shirt out of it? No? Okay. All right, that's all right. Well, you know how it's a pain, right? You know how that when you run out of storage space, it's a pain. Well, this is going to be look how easy this is. Add a physical disk. I'm going to add this physical disk into the system. Click OK. And wow, look at that. Now we have enough space, right? So, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, now that we've configured our storage spaces, I want to move on to data deduplication. This helps you to not only this helps you to save space on the existing storage that you already have. What I'm going to do is do this via PowerShell. So we've got this volume E here, and I'm first going to this feature is already installed, so that should run here, and you'll see how that's already installed. You enable the feature for deduplication or the feature on the drive. Then we need to enable deduplication on the volume itself. I'm going to highlight this to enable it on volume E, which is our Australian storage pool. Okay? And it shows you how it's enabled, and you haven't saved any space at this point. Zero save space. One of the other things I want to do is also set the minimum file age for the purposes of this demo to zero. That means that it's going to try and compress all of the files that that are on there, even if they're brand new. Okay? Now, what I'm going to do is copy a couple files over to that store. So in this case, I've just got the Windows Server DVD, and no, we don't want to install that. When we go to sources, I'm just going to go to the boot.wim file here. I'm going to copy that. And I'm going to put that into my storage pool, just paste it in there. So that's about 200 megabytes on this drive. I'm going to rename it. And I'm going to copy the same file again into this share. Now, for deduplication to save you space, it doesn't have to be, it can save you space in other ways other than just copying the same file. But this is a really simple example, so you get the idea. So now we've got two of the same file on there with two different names. And what we're going to do is enable deduplication to optimize on this drive. So we're going to kick off an optimization job here. And then we're going to check the job status of the optimization just to kind of speed things up a bit. Now, by default, right, this is going to run periodically in your environment, but we're going to just, you know, we've kind of forced it to happen to make things a little quicker. So you'll notice there the progress is 0 and 100%. So it just finished. And when we go to check the git dedupe status, you'll notice here that we've saved 200 megs of space. Right over here, it's 200 megs of space, which is the size of one of the WIM files. So effectively, even though this has technically 400 megs of data on this drive, it's only utilizing 200 megs of space. So this is a really simple example, but I've seen, has anybody ever used this by any chance in the environment? Anybody? Like one or two guys. And how much space did either of you two save? 40%. How about you? 60%. Okay, you go ahead and get a shirt here. Thanks. Come on up. All right, so we'll keep things going. Deduplication, you like it? Yeah. All right. Okay, web and application support. Of course, one of the big things that we want to do is continue to increase our density and the multi-tenancy support for our environment. So if you're running a lot of different web servers or a high volume of web traffic in your environment, or especially if you're hosters, IIS 8 and Windows Server 2012 is going to help you out a lot. Dynamic IP restrictions is really useful for enhanced security. And, of course, there's a number of things built into the core OS where we prevent denial of service attacks. But with IIS 7.x, what you'd have to do is go in often or sometimes and go through logs and kind of a scripted process to try and protect against people that are attacking you. Now, inside of Windows Server 2012 and IIS 8, it's simply a GUI wizard where you click on an option, and you now have the ability to specify parameters to say if people are you know, having all these different things, block them from having access dynamically. We then have centralized SSL management. For if you have a lot of different servers and a lot of different sites, you'd have to do one of two things. You'd either have to script the install of those certificates via policy or whatever other means you have across all these different servers, or you'd have to manually import those certificates across the different machines. Well, in IIS 8 in Windows Server 2012, we have the ability to specify a central store for all your certificates. You can specify a single certificate in the store, and all of your web servers are able to utilize that single certificate with nothing else really required. Just works with PHP. For those of you that don't know, you know, IIS is a great platform, even for performance, of non-.NET code. So if you're running PHP, JavaScript, we have world-class performance on our platform, and we make it even easier now in Windows Server 2012 to run non-.NET workloads on top of IIS. And embracing with standards. So, you know, we want to continue to embrace the standards that are out there for the web. So, for instance, if you've got HTML5 applications, you're naturally going to want to be able to have an on-premise or a platform up in the cloud to be able to support those latest standards. And we do that in Windows Server 2012. Okay. With that, I'm going to snap to demos, and we're going to cover CPU throttling and NUMA-aware scalability. Give me 1 second here. Okay. We've got an IIS server here. And underneath the IIS server, we have application pools. And enabling the support for CPU throttling is very easy. All you need to do is right-click on this, go to Advanced Setting for the Application Pool, and in this case, I'm going to say to leave it. Our first start here is that by default, there's no CPU throttling and there's no action. We're going to click OK to that, and what'll happen is, by default, what can happen is if you're on a web server and let's say there's a busy bad code, for instance, on a single application or web app that just consumes all of your resources. And that's what we're going to initiate here when I click on this busy app. And when we go to Task Manager, you'll notice that the CPU is getting hammered here, where we have, 57%, 65% continuing to peg out the processor on this IIS server from just a single thread. I'm going to close these out just so you can see how that this is going to be fixed with CPU throttling. Close this all out. And now we're going to go in and we're going to enable CPU throttling and see the same thing happen with CPU throttling enabled. In this case, I'm going to say 15%. I only want to limit this pool or this application pool to 15% of the total CPU. And the limit action is going to be throttle. I'm going to choose to throttle that down when that starts to occur. When we click OK, and then we go back to enable this busy thread that's killing the processor, and we go back into Task Manager, you'll notice that the CPU here is hovering right around 5%, 4%, right? It's minimizing the impact to that overall server right from with a simple couple clicks. All right. Yeah, thank you. You can clap. Yeah. All right. The NUMA scalability, this is really easy. This is in order for your, let's say, heavy intensive web applications to take advantage of the additional resources across, possibly multiple servers or even a single server, all you need to do is just change this maximum worker process to zero, and there you have that support or that functionality for the new, if it's a NUMA-aware system. Okay, I'm going to go back now into the slides. We've got to keep rolling here. Okay, networking. Networking is kind of important. Without networking, right, things aren't going to go so well for you. And we really needed to improve upon the networking capabilities to take advantage of scalability and it's at the hub of everything, right? So you really need to amp up the performance overall. Number one is NIC teaming. Well, it used to be in Server 2008 R2 that you could enable NIC teaming, but it was really something that was only available if your vendor supported it, right? So if your vendor supported it and if the NIC supported it, then it's going to work okay for you. Well, now in Windows Server 2012, we support any variety of NICs. It doesn't really matter. I mean, of course, as long as there's a driver for it on Windows Server 2012, you can team NICs of different vendors, different varieties, and we have our own support to do the NIC teaming inside the environment. This really enables you to have more resiliency, failover, possibly performance even, for your connectivity built out of the box in Windows Server 2012. Network virtualization, again, this ties back to Hyper-V a lot as well, but we mentioned the multiple layers on the network. Single root I/O virtualization. For those of you, how many have heard of this? I'm just kind of curious. How many have heard of that? Okay, like three of you, yeah. It's really just certain types of hardware. It's a standards-based protocol, but when you have that there, it's able to take ability of the performance enhancements of connecting directly to things like the network card, right, to give you that additional performance on your machine. Okay, resource metering. Resource metering enables you to detect what is the network utilization for whatever you want, for network cards, for virtualization machines, and this helps support a chargeback model in combination with feature number 8 there, quality of service. So there, you combine those two features, you have a very powerful effect to do a chargeback system, for instance, with VMs, right? You have VMs, and you want people to say you only get a certain utilization for whatever you're paying for. Next up, we have branch cache. All right, I'm curious, how many people have used branch cache in their environment? Like 2, 3, okay. All right, so can one of you, do you want to make a comment on how you use branch cache? What? No, nobody wants to? Okay, that's all right. Well, branch cache, right, really enables things to be much faster for your users that have branch offices, right? It helps you to save a lot of bandwidth transfers and make things a lot quicker for those people in the branch office. Well, in Windows Server 2012, there's quite a few enhancements. One of the big ones I'll point out is the fact that now branch cache can be utilized by more things than just file servers, because there's a number of other applications or things that might want to plug into that, third parties or other people. We've enabled that extensibility so that it's not just about files anymore. And then finally, we have 10, SMB Direct and Multi-Channel. All right, how many people have seen the TechEd keynote from Jeff Woolsey in North America or Europe where we get 1 million IOPS? Anybody seen that? Okay, definitely recommend checking that section out. But we had 1 million IOPS on a single VM. Naturally, that is going to take a lot of networking to make that happen. So SMB Direct and Multi-Channel is one of the technologies where you can use multiple NICs to improve the overall bandwidth between different devices inside your network. Okay. Going to give you a little bit of a demo of this DHCP failover and IPAM. IPAM has that one has a full 75-minute session from my colleague in the back of the room there. Let's go into this here. Okay, I'm going to go back to my admin client. Go to my multi-server management console. And the concept with the general premise for IPAM is you have a number of challenges because you've got a number of different DHCP servers and DNS servers inside your environment. You've got all these IP addresses around in different places, and so this makes it really easy for you to centralize where you have all of your information. You'll notice here when we go to server inventory, it picks up and shows right here that there's DNS, DHCP on these roles. And what we can do is, right from here within this context, we can do things like connect up to the DHCP server. So we can go in here and we can edit a DHCP scope with a new window here. This is a new UI, right? It doesn't look like what you'll see inside of the regular MMC, but it gives you a centralized place to apply these network policies inside your environment. And what I'm gonna do now is connect to the MMC and show you the DHCP failover and how easy that is to configure. Now in Windows Server 2002, You could do some things to do failover. It was a little more challenging. In Server 2012, you make it super easy to enable this. Remember earlier I enabled DHCP on Server 1. So now we've connected up to Server 1. Let's say that I want to, let me expand this. It's a little bigger for you to see. Let's say that I want to, you'll notice on Server 1 there's no scopes assigned here. Okay, and on this DC we've got one address pool here of for DHCP. Well, what I can do is right click on this and then choose configure failover. I can configure this DHCP server to failover by a few clicks here when we enable failover. Pops up with a window here, and we're going to click next for that particular network for all the scopes that are there. If you had multiple scopes, you could choose individual scopes you want to fail over or specific ones. The partner server, we're going to say, is the one we have authorized, which is server 1 that we just added earlier in our previous demos. We're going to choose next. And we're going to enable the authentication just to make sure things are secure. We'll just type a password here. And here you have the ability to specify, do you want it to be a hot standby in case there's a total failure of a DHCP server? Or do you want to load balance things? In this case, I'll just choose load balance and we'll do half and half here. I'll choose next, choose finish. That was successful for the failover. And when we refresh this guy, we notice we've got a new scope here. And guess what? The address leases we see are shared between the two devices. Pretty easy, huh? Work across sites. DHCP, yes, it does. Yeah, so you can have that work across different sites. If you want to know more about this, the IPAM stuff, definitely attend the 75-minute session on it. Okay. All right. Let's get into security and access. We've got about 20 minutes left, and we're doing good here on time. All right. Security and access. Security for, you know, for some folks is kind of one of those things you want to think about after the fact, but I think more and more, you know, you're going to need to start thinking about it in the forefront. Security and access is one of those things that are near and dear to my heart. I've got a lot of history there, but we've done a number of things to really make security a lot easier for you in Windows Server 2012. I'm going to give you a demo of those first three features that will help out in that area. But when you look at number 4, simpler deployment of Active Directory. Well, it used to be in Server 2002, right, what you would do is you would, you know, join a machine to the domain, you'd then type DC promo with the right credentials, you'd go through a whole bunch of wizards, you'd have some reboots and replication and a number of other things. Well, we've made it a lot easier in Windows Server 2012, where once you add the role, there's a very quick and easy wizard to enable that DC to be promoted. 5, DNS security, DNSSEC extensions. We've made enhancements here to DNS to make sure that you don't have any updates that come in that are not valid, right? You want to make sure that there's no DNS poisoning and things like that. DNSSEC helps out with that situation. Then Active Directory virtualization. Okay, so I have a fun question. And you don't have to explain a story or anything if you don't want. But I want to ask, has anybody had to deal with something called USN rollback? Anybody? USN rollback. There's been, okay, maybe like 5 or 10 of you. If you want, for a shirt and a poster, does somebody want to explain very quickly, like what happened with that? What did you have to do when you had that happen? Yep, and then what'd you have to do to fix that? Yeah. Yeah, so you had a new DC, there's a lot of issues there, and if you set it as authoritative, so to recap for those of you that didn't hear, so what he had happen is he had a backup of a DC, right? He restored that backup to, and go ahead and come on up and get your shirt here. Thank you. What he had happen was a backup restored to of a DC and from a previous version of Active Directory in a snapshot. Well, what happened is, you know, that can potentially, right, what happened is it caused a problem where he had to not only restore it, but if he had set that to authoritative, it would have destroyed the domain or the forest of all the old credentials there, right? Because those USNs get pushed out to the entire environment. Well, with Active Directory virtualization in Windows Server 2012, we have the ability for DCs that are running Windows Server 2012, we can detect if it's a virtual DC or not. So if somebody accidentally says, oh, I'm just going to restore my DC from a snapshot, right? The Windows Server 2012 will pop up and say, oh, okay, this is not a good situation, and it'll help save you. Now, for Active Directory, if you stay in this room, Pete has a 75-minute session right after this giving you 75 minutes on the Active Directory improvements in Windows Server 2012. One of the other ones being cloning, right? So it makes it super easy to just provision a clone and almost just deploy an Active Directory server outside of your environment. Kerberos constrained delegation. How many people have had to configure Kerberos constrained delegation? I'm just curious. Like one. Okay. Was it super easy? No. Okay. Yes, two of you. All right. So have a shirt for this, for kudos for working with it. In Windows Server 2012, we've made it much easier for you to configure Kerberos delegation in the environment. You no longer have to be a domain admin in order to do this, and we enable the ownership back to the resource owner. All right, now let's go into some more demos. We're first off I'm gonna show you classification is the first thing I want to show you inside the environment. Classification. How many people, I'm curious, how many people are using classification inside your environment? You can do it in Server 2008 R2. Anybody? Nobody's using classification. Okay. So I'm going to explain to you why classification is extremely powerful and why you really should start thinking about utilizing it. Well, I'm going to show you how classification works. And when we click on files or folders, we have the ability to manually classify them. You'll notice here there's this classification tab. Now I've lit up these two particular classifications, which this is all configurable. And again, there's longer sessions on how to do all this. But the general principle here is that under this classification tab, you have the ability to specify different values. So in this case, let's say this folder is a sales document or a sales tagged or classified as sales for the department. When we go under here, you'll notice I've manually classified and said that this country is United States. The other thing you'll see here is that it's inherited, right? Because the folder above it was Department Sales, I've now also have the country specified as United States. So it's attributed both of those values. Furthermore, if we go down and we just put new files in here, I'll just call it a bitmap image, hit enter, and when we click properties on that image, you'll notice on classification, that file automatically had, because it's in that folder, it has country as United States and Department of Sales. So that in and of itself, right, is a way to manually classify. Now you can automatically classify things, you can inspect content like Word docs or Office docs for things like this is confidential or classified, and you can automatically tag them in all kinds of ways. This is just a really simple example of how you can manually classify. Classification in and of itself, though, right, if you just classify, it's like, meh, not going to really do a whole lot for you. But there are a lot of things that you can do tied to classification. So for instance, if we want to set permissions using this concept called dynamic access control to different files and folders. So what I'm going to show you now is a little bit about one of the ways that you can use classification to intelligently assign permissions to different folders. So here's the challenge, right? You probably have a lot of different file shares and a lot of different data across a lot of places. Right? We realize that. And you know, the way it stands now, does anybody want to, for a shirt, want to tell me the acronym of how you're supposed to assign users to groups and assign that to resources? Somebody want to tell me that? AGLP, thank you. You're a speaker, so you don't get a shirt, Pete, but yes, that's the way that you're supposed to do it, right? AGLP, you're supposed to assign, you know, this hierarchy of things, right? And so you'd have a crazy amount of groups, like hundreds, if not thousands of groups, if you did it by our recommended best practice ways of doing things with using NTFS. And right, when you would do that, you'd be tied to groups, right, and group memberships to assign permissions to shares. Well, with dynamic access control and potentially this classification that you light up, you can enable a huge amount of power to assign permissions. So for instance here, when I click add, I'm gonna just choose, let's say, domain users. Okay. And when domain users is kind of a generic thing, because at the bottom we're going to say add a condition, and this is where the power really comes in. Okay, when we click on this, you can say a user, and here you see in this drop-down list there's country and department listed here. So these are the values that I lit up, and I say, so let's say when user country equals the resource country, meaning the file, you know, when we set the classification on that file server, it matches that country as you just saw. We then are going to now say that for when the user's claim of the user belongs to a certain country, when that user belongs to the United States and the folder is classified as United States, we're going to then give that user read access to the share. Okay? So here we have read and execute permissions based on attributes that are in Active Directory. So now, right, what would happen, right, if in the old way of doing things, in the old way of doing things with this AGLP, what would happen if a user moved from, you know, one state to another? You'd have to remove their groups. Yeah, you'd have to have some way to figure out all the groups that they're in. You got to hope that you didn't have any manual assigned permissions to shares that they shouldn't be on, right, and re-put all those back in. Right, so, but now when you assign this and you have the claims associated to Active Directory, you now, if that person moves, it's done. You don't have to rechange anything, right? You've got a very powerful way here's for you here. There's a very powerful way for you to assign permissions to your file shares. Okay, now I can the way to push this out to multiple shares would be this thing called central policy, and I don't have time to get into that. But there's a way to say, let's create a central policies just like the ones I mentioned and push those out to all your file servers. So effectively, you can set it in one central location. You could have hundreds or thousands of file servers, sign that via group policy, and then now you've got effective permissions across all those servers, and you've done it in a central way that is scalable. What do you think? Okay. All right. Let's keep it going. We are coming close to an end here. All right, virtual desktop infrastructure. This is that pillar of people being able to work anywhere from any device that you want to have inside of your environment. The first off is a simplified user connection with VDI. What happens here is, you are able to now specify just an email address. You give, most people can remember their email address, so you tell them their email address, and once they put that in, they now have a quickly automated way to get their desktops, remote apps, and everything automatically onto their client device. Makes it a lot easier for the users. User profile disks. Okay, how many people in here, I'm curious, are using VDI in some way, shape, or form? Like maybe, I don't know, maybe 20%, 15%? Okay. Well, if you've worked with pooled VDI, meaning you've got a single VM image that people just keep connecting to, right? And once the user disconnects, that image just gets reset, right? Well, with that scenario, you know, and a user wants to save some data when they connect up to that virtual desktop, then, you know, they don't have that ability, right? Until now, with Windows Server 2012, we have user profile disks. That way, when somebody connects, you can assign with pooled VDI, where every time they connect, even though that core base image gets reset, they have their own little storage space of their own files or whatever they want to store that are able to be attached to that virtual desktop instance. Okay, fair share of session virtualization. In Windows Server 2008 R2, we had an intelligent way for your to share the load of CPU between your different users. So if you have that guy who's you know, streaming lots of HD videos on one of his session, or, you know, crunching hard numbers, right? You could throttle his CPU. Well, that's great, but in Server 2012, we now have the ability to throttle disk and network as well to give you a better fair share across the entire stack of resources. Intelligent patching. How many people have had to deal with a patch storm with VDI for those 10 or so percent of people that have had to do this? Anybody? No? Okay. So thankfully you haven't had to deal with that. In Windows Server 2012, we make it much smarter and intelligent to not have all of your VMs make updates at the same time. We have ways to kind of scale that out so that, you know, when it's 3 a.m. on Patch Tuesday, your servers don't get hammered, right, with their disk I.O. trying to download updates and apply them all to the disks. RDS Smart Cache, we now have a way to help you reduce your SMB storage costs by some of those features being able to stream them over SMB. Concurrent redirection, we have some enhancements to make it easier to redirect the sessions across the different machines in your environment. And then remote effects. All right, remote effects used to be a technology in Windows Server 2008 R2 where you're like, okay, I have to have this remote effects card, and there's all these things that I have to do, and it really just helped improve your graphics performance. Well, in Windows Server 2012, remote effects is now kind of a larger subset of things. So when you reference remote effects, you're talking about things like USB redirection, touch, the functionality that you get over a WAN, the adaptive graphics, all of these things are kind of lumped inside of remote effects. And the other great thing is that you don't have to have a remote effects adapter to take advantage of a lot or most all of these capabilities. You can use a software-based GPU to give you the things like, you know, USB redirection and touch inside your environment. So it makes it a lot easier for you to get all the different capabilities that you'd expect with these additional enhancements. Remote effects over WAN, for instance, it used to be, as I think Michael Leeworthy pointed out in the plenary, when you'd use VDI, it was really only really a good experience over a LAN. We've now made it so that you have over a WAN, you can still have a good experience no matter where you're at and what kind of connection you have in your environment. Okay, I've got about 5 minutes left, and we've got one quick wizard VDI session that I want to show you how easy it is to deploy VDI. How many have seen quick deploy VDI? Nobody. Okay, good. It's a good demo then. So let's show you how simple it is. In Windows Server 2008 R2, pretty, you know, there was like 100 something odd page white paper. And there were a lot of, you know, there were a lot of complexities as far as the order and the way you did things. In Windows Server 2012, we've made it extremely easy to deploy VDI inside your environment. I'm going to show you. All we need to do is click on Add Roles. We're going to choose the special option of Remote Desktop Services Installation. Choose Next. And you've got two choices here. You've got a quick start or a standard deployment. Because I want to deploy this the fastest way possible, I'm going to choose Quick Start. Choose Next. Deployment scenario. Here you've got the choice of virtual machine-based desktop deployment or session-based desktop deployment. With virtual machine-based deployment, you've got pooled VDI or personal VDI. And you've got essentially those choices would be running a VM disk via Hyper-V that people are connecting to. Session-based desktop deployment is what you might be familiar with already, remote desktop services or terminal services, right? We've now lumped this under the same category of VDI. Now, because this is a VM, I'm just going to choose session-based desktop deployment because you can't deploy VM inside of a VM. So I'm going to choose session-based desktop deployment, click Next, choose which server I want to go through. It has reboots pending, so I'm just going to click Exclude. And after that, literally, all that you would need to do after this is click Next, Finish, and that's it. So, like any good cooking show, that installs and does things, comes back up, and like any good cooking show, I have one of these already configured. So, in this here, we're going to go to our server one. Actually, I'll go to admin client. And we're going to show you remote desktop services. Hold on one second here. Okay. So this is what it would look like. This was after a quick start. I literally did not do anything else to this after the quick start configuration. It rebooted. You'll see that you have RD web access there. You've got a connection broker to connect the machines to the different session hosts that are there. And why don't you see what this looks like from an end user perspective? So when we go back to RD Web Access, this is the website that's there by default. This is, you'll notice, server one. This is the one that was already configured with session-based virtualization. I didn't have to do anything to get that configured. So here, I'm just going to log in via my admin password. And once I connect up, I can connect to a different session. Here's the other cool thing. I can connect to any kind of remote PC. So any server that I had inside my environment that's accessible through the gateway, I could then connect up. So for instance, if I want to connect to server one, click connect. It's going to then pull up a remote desktop connection. Type in my password again. And there we go. Now, right through there, I've had access, and I could be anywhere out on the internet, wherever else, and I'm through HTTP. I'm tunneling this RDP session back into my corporate environment, and I've done that via really just a few clicks. So, what do you think? All right. Well, that's about all the time we have. Let me go back to kind of close it out and give you some resources here that you can utilize moving forward. So, call out a few things here that you may not be aware of. Microsoft Virtual Academy. We've got quite a few tracks on Microsoft Virtual Academy. It's free learning, and you can prove your skills by taking assessments and getting points and things like that to learn various products, not just Windows Server 2012, but we recently put up about 5 different tracks, and we're continuing to pump new content on there if you want to have guided learning experiences. Windows Server 2012 evaluation, just if you want a shortcut link to find that. And then the Edge show. Us at Corp, we have a weekly show. It's targeted for you guys, IT pros. We give usually about a 4-minute news piece, so you can keep up to date with whatever's relevant news from Microsoft for IT pros. And then we also have a deep technical dive. We usually spend about 15, 20 minutes with a program manager right from Redmond on specific topic areas. So for instance, the whole month this month, Server Launch Month, we have episodes focused on Windows Server. The last episode I shot with the program manager for Direct Access. So you can go check that out. And thank you very much for attending my session. I'll be available later at Showcase and in the Speaker Lounge. I also have a session later, Enabling Consumerization of IT. And I've got a short section on Windows 8 apps for this Dev 223 session.